From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Alabama is taking a major drug maker to court over the opioid epidemic. Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall alleges in a new lawsuit that Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, fueled a public health crisis with deceptive marketing practices. And Attorney General Marshall joins us now from Montgomery. Attorney General, welcome. And what exactly is your case against the company?
Well, I think it's a broad-based allegation, one of which is if you look at the most current data, Alabama is number one per capita in the country relating to opioid prescriptions, almost 1.2 per person. We've seen our overdose deaths quadruple since 2006, and we continue to see the impact it has on communities throughout our state as a result of not only the addiction that we see, but more importantly, the loss of life.
Why do you think it's so bad in Alabama?
Well, I think it's a great question, and one that we've just spent the last 4 months as part of an opioid council that I was one of the co-chairs, where we really sort of tried to take a deep dive into Alabama and try to come up with answers as to how we got into the situation we're in, but more importantly, how it is that we're going to be able to continue to move forward. And I do think that there are still many unanswered questions. One of the things that we do know, and we heard quite frequently from physicians, what they deemed to be the lies that they were told and trained in over the years, whether it be that there was no dosage too high of an opioid that could be given to a patient, or that even this concept of a pseudo-addiction, that if somebody appeared in an office demonstrating signs of addiction, that truly was just meant that they needed more pain medication. And so, not only did we understand and hear from families, but we heard from those who were practitioners that they felt like that over the years they had been deceived as to how this medication was to be used, and more importantly, the length of time in which a patient should receive it.
Are you finding in Alabama what other states are finding, which is that many people who end up overdosing or dying after being addicted to opioids started out with a prescription for a legitimate reason?
Yeah, and I think that's what the data is telling us, that roughly 80% of those who have an overdose from fentanyl or heroin abused an opioid before they began using those drugs. And so, we believe that there's a direct connection between that, and it's one reason why, we continue to see the rise of heroin, fentanyl, and carfentanil in our communities around the country, because that is really, if we look at the significant reason for the overdoses, those are the drugs that are causing it, but that there is a direct connection between an opioid and those particular illicit drugs.
So why target Purdue in particular?
Well, the largest manufacturer, in what we've seen, at least from our data, is that they supply a majority of the opioids in our state and have done so historically. And one of the things I think gets lost is that when people see that there's a complaint filed against a company, they just sort of assume it's for money damages. And although our complaint seeks money damages, it's the injunctive relief that I think is the most compelling, is that if we look at the ways in this country that we're going to be able to deal with this problem, there are really sort of three areas that we focus on, prevention being one, treatment being the other, but also the supply of opioids in our communities. And so if we're seeking injunctive relief, we need the assistance and agreement of those manufacturers in that effort. And was very impressed as I spent last Wednesday in Cleveland with Judge Polster, who is the MDL judge for all of these cases nationally. And he brought together groups of manufacturers, distributors, as well as state's attorneys general and other plaintiffs to really talk about this idea of how are we going to reduce the loss of life in this country. And so we want to be leaders in trying to be able to not only talk about the financial harm that's suffered in our states, but how it is that we can go about saving lives.
You say that they're the largest manufacturer, but in fact, they say that they only account for a tiny fraction of all opioid prescriptions.
And I guess that's what litigation is about, and so we'll continue to have that discussion. There's no doubt that there are other manufacturers that are in this field, but when we look at OxyContin, we look at MS-Cotton, Dilaudid, those type of drugs, and the way that those drugs were marketed to physicians and others. I mean, I think that's going to be part of the discussion in these complaints as well as many of the other complaints that have been filed.
I think about other cases like this in the past. It almost seems like you're going up against one of the tobacco companies. To go up against a pharmaceutical company, how difficult is that? They've got, tons and tons of lawyers who will say that they didn't do anything wrong.
They do. I mean, and that's like any litigation that we see. But, you know, I've always believed, as somebody that's tried cases most of my professional career, that facts matter. You know, I've heard that old saying that facts are stubborn things, and that regardless of the quality of your lawyer, nobody can change the facts. And I do think our complaint sets out a very compelling case for how we got into this situation. And then we will begin to be able to make our claims in court to the extent we have to litigate it, and believe very confidently that we can do that in a way that allows us to prevail. But my hope is that these cases bring people together to begin having that discussion of where we are going forward. And to the credit of manufacturers and distributors, I heard them say that they want to be a part of a solution. And so let's just simply hope that people can come together and come forward with not only a strategic plan about how we can deal with this nationally, but again, being able to allow that to be focused on how we save lives in this country. It's concerning when our, you know, average lifespan has reduced in the last 2 years, and this being the principal reason why. And we've got to be able to make a difference in this issue nationally.
That's Steve Marshall, who is the Attorney General of the state of Alabama, which has filed a new lawsuit against Purdue Pharma. That's the maker of OxyContin. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
And Purdue Pharma declined our request for an interview. In a statement, they said, "We vigorously deny these allegations and look forward to the opportunity to present our defense."
Well, we want to look now at a coastal phenomenon in the Pacific Northwest, extra high tides in winter, king tides, which push water right up to the edge of some homes and businesses. And climatologists say these tides will only get worse as sea levels rise. EarthFix reporter Eilish O'Neill visited vulnerable communities in Oregon and Washington State.
Tom and Marie Course live on the far east side of Port Townsend, on the northeast point of Washington State's Olympic Peninsula.
We are on the beach. Yep.
Since the Course's house was built 3 decades ago, ice caps have been melting, and the ocean's been expanding as it warms up. The Courses got a taste of just how close the sea might come to their home in March 2016, when a massive storm blew into Port Townsend at the same time as a king tide. A king tide is an extra high tide that happens in the winter, when the moon is closer to the Earth. Scientists say king tides can give us an idea of what normal high tides will look like within a couple decades. That day in March 2016, just before dawn, 60-mile-per-hour winds pushed the unusually high water toward the Course's house.
We probably had 4 to 6 foot waves coming ashore here. There was a lot of spray hitting the east side of our house, and you could feel vibrations coming through the house. I got out of bed and came out and looked, and I thought, oh my goodness, if this goes on, we're going to have to move the house.
On the West Coast, nearly 200,000 people live on land that's likely to get flooded during the next few decades. And it's not just houses that are at risk. It's billions of dollars of infrastructure. Sewage treatment plants could be destroyed by salt water and need to be modified or moved. The Port of Tacoma and other highly contaminated Superfund sites could soon be underwater, and hundreds of miles of roads might get regularly flooded.
The implications of sea level rise are more expensive than we could ever imagine having budget to cover.
Guillaume Moget is an expert on flooding and climate change adaptation at the University of Washington. He says, even if we stop emitting carbon tomorrow,
we're virtually guaranteed to get 6 inches of sea level rise in the next 50 years.
It's more than a foot above where the sea was in 1900, which is when a lot of the region's infrastructure was built. Moget adds, even though the West Coast storms aren't as dramatic as storms on the East Coast, communities here are just as vulnerable to sea level rise because homes and infrastructure are built so close to the water. One way to get a glimpse of the future is to look at a king tide today. That's why I headed to Bud Inlet during one of January's king tides to meet Eric Christensen, who does sea level rise planning with the City of Olympia's Public Works Department.
We're looking at Bud Inlet in the City of Olympia.
Bud Inlet's on the very southern tip of Puget Sound.
We've got a tide coming in that should hit about 17 feet, which happens a few times a year here. You know, with a foot of sea level rise, we could see this happening maybe 30 times a year. A few times a year, we'd see water creep over the shoreline and flood up to 20, 25 square blocks of downtown.
Christensen says a tide like today's, plus that 6 inches of sea level rise scientists say we're guaranteed to get, could mean...
You'll begin to see water in the streets. This corner here will flood. Columbia Street, the next block over, will flood. The parking lot that you parked in, you wouldn't want to walk to your car.
Christensen estimates it will cost $60 to $65 million to protect downtown Olympia from a rising sea. But if the city does nothing to prepare, the damage would cost billions.
Sea level rise is inevitable, and sea level rise is going to change the landscape. This is my community, and I feel very strongly that I'd like to protect it.
Back in Port Townsend, Tom and Marie Corse's short-term plan is to keep building the berm between the beach and their house higher and higher. But long-term?
These houses will probably have to be moved. That's probably the final outcome, but it won't affect Marie and myself because we'll be gone.
For Here and Now, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
Today, Senate leaders announced a new 2-year bipartisan budget deal that would increase military and domestic spending ahead of the government funding deadline tomorrow night. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
This budget deal is a genuine breakthrough. After months of fiscal brinkmanship, this budget deal is the first real sprout of bipartisanship.
Last night, the House passed its own plan, but it's a short-term spending plan that would run through March 25th.
Here now, political analysts join us now. Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And John Brabender, Republican strategist. Hi, John.
Hello.
And there's no immigration in this deal, it sounds like. Jamal, is it a good deal? Should Democrats support it?
Well, it depends on which Democrats. We've already seen Nancy Pelosi wave the flag that without having immigration in the deal, she'll vote against it and will encourage some of her members to vote against it. I think if you're part of the base of the Democratic Party that is concerned about the immigration and the DACA debate, you're not going to be happy about this. But for the broader Democratic electorate, you may see people go along with Schumer just to move this along.
Well, what about President Trump? Here he is yesterday. He also, just as Nancy Pelosi wanted to vote on extending deportation protections for the DACA recipients to go along with this vote, Trump wants immigrant reform. He's linking inaction on immigrant gang violence and border security to a shutdown. Listen.
If we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13. There are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country.
But John Brabender, we just heard that there were the sprouts of bipartisanship and that Mitch McConnell is joining with Schumer on a plan that doesn't have immigration reform.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that word, bipartisanship. Could you define it?
It's a sprout.
I've heard that before. No, I mean, look, I think, first of all, the White House has signaled that because there's increased military spending, increased spending on opioids, that they are willing to move on this. I think Jamal's right in the sense that the ultimate battle on this is going to be in the House and not the Senate on two fronts. You're going to have Nancy Pelosi, who's been playing a little bit of a game of chicken on immigration and the Dreamers, and you're going to have some of the conservatives in the House on the Republican side, concerned about how much spending is going to be in this. So there's still a ways to go. I would argue, though, that Schumer probably felt that the shutdown worked against them. The 3-day shutdown worked against the Democrats and felt some pressure to get something done. So I think this is both a good sign that there's some unity, but I also think it's politically driven in many cases.
But, John, we're talking about increasing spending both domestically and for the military in this deal. You know, Republicans just passed this tax cut plan, which also adds a ton of money to the debt. Is that concern just gone in the Republican Party at this point, do you think?
Well, not in the House, it won't be. And that's why I'm saying there's work to do on this, in that this will give pause to quite a few in the conservative side of the Republican Party, particularly fiscal conservatives, who say, this is not what I ran for, this is not what I signed up for. And so that's why I think whatever the Senate agreed to is unlikely to be the final passage.
Yeah, in fact, let's listen to North Carolina Republican Mark Meadows, who's leader of the conservative House Freedom Caucus. He told CNN he, for this reason, opposes the deal. He does think it'll pass, but let's listen.
I'm afraid that the numbers will get so high that and the debt ceiling will get added and it will be a Christmas tree of spending that a lot of votes will be bought.
Well, so concerns there about spending, as you said, John. But Jamal, Well, I just want to touch again on the concern of, you know, what's going to happen to the DACA vote. It had been sort of leveraged for both sides for different reasons. It runs out March 5th. What's your sense of what's going to happen there? Is this just going to be something that they will do a standalone vote on?
Well, McConnell has promised to move the DACA deal forward. The stumbling block here is Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan seems to be completely owned by the Freedom Caucus and by the White House, and he seems to be doing the business of these two different groups of people. But before we leave this idea of the budget deficit, this is why Republicans are so two-faced when it comes to this. They just passed a tax bill that is going to explode the budget deficit by $1.5 trillion, and we're arguing over whether or not those members in the House are arguing over whether or not we can increase infrastructure spending by $20 billion. If they were so concerned about the deficit, they would have stopped that tax bill.
Well, we're expecting to get the Trump administration's infrastructure spending plan on Monday. John, do you think it's going to be just pennies, or will it be something significant?
Well, look, I think Trump is honestly dedicated to doing something that's substantial. I think he's right in saying that our infrastructure is crumbling. I think the challenge is going to be, how the heck do you pay for it? I think that's where a lot of people
you weren't concerned about paying for it when you were passing a $1.5 trillion tax bill that we don't need. It's putting more money in the hands of wealthy people who don't need it. And now we're starting to see an economy that might be heating up too much.
The U.S. Treasury this week came out and said 91% of taxpayers will get a tax cut. There's already 3 million people who have got a bonus. We saw that Apple is bringing it over $40 billion back to the country to be reinvested. And we see that we have the lowest unemployment rate in 17 years. So, you know, what the president
said. We've had unemployment rate dropping.
You didn't say anything about the stock market this time, John. Why aren't you talking about the stock market?
But let's talk about that then. The stock market went up again yesterday. It went up, going up today, from my understanding. And that there was a correction because people are worried about how well the economy is doing and the inflation that comes with that. And so I think that most people that are now seeing their take-home pay going up in their paychecks are probably not going to do a lot of complaining. And frankly, I think most people feel they deserve more money and Washington deserves less. And I think that's what the president did with his tax cut.
Let's just remember, we're borrowing $1.5 trillion from the Chinese and other people to put $15 or $22 a week in someone's paycheck.
Well, go ahead, John.
Who makes less than $70,000.
John, cap that off.
Well, look, all I know is that the deficit and debt, everything exploded under the Obama administration. And now that Trump is doing anything that turns around the economy and gets it going to the level that it is, it's like all of a sudden the Democrats have become these fiscal hawks that didn't exist for the last 8 years.
Okay, so we're going to leave it there. There's going to be a lot of disagreement in the cyberspace about what you just said. But I want to move on to some other things that we've heard this week, because some of them seemed to come out of nowhere. What do you make of White House Chief of Staff John Kelly? Described why he thinks some of the young immigrants brought here illegally as children didn't apply for the DACA program. And again, this is the program that shields them from deportation.
Some would say we're too afraid to sign up. Others would say we're too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
Jamal, where did that come from? There's one thing that people across the board and across the political spectrum say about the Dreamers or the DACA recipients is that they are hardworking.
Well, some would say that the chief of staff is a bigot or is playing on prejudice. I'm not sure who those people are, but some might say that. I think that this is a shame, because people looked at John Kelly as someone who was going to be a moderating influence on the president and help control his worst impulses. And what we are learning bit by bit, week by week, is that perhaps John Kelly shares some of the president's worst impulses and will not, in fact, be a moderating influence that looks out for people in the country versus playing to the narrow base that's worried about immigration the way the president is.
What about the military parade? We have to talk about that. John, the president wants a military parade, which is very unusual in this country. It's not unprecedented, but it's unusual. And it's unusual in a lot of countries that are not sort of totalitarian. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's got to be viewed under what context we're going to do it. I would agree that if this is a display of just might, then I don't think that's the purpose to do it. If this is to show a display of that we will never be bullied by anybody, that we are going to stand up all around the world when we see somebody being bullied, that we're going to honor our veterans, we're going to honor the people who serve this country, and it's going to show a unity around that idea, that's fine. But it does trouble me a little bit if this is certainly what we see in other countries from time to time, which is nothing more than just a show of might and heavy metal.
This seems an awful lot more like the president is asking for the troops to honor him than it is for him to honor the troops. If he really wanted to honor the troops, the president would go to Iraq or Afghanistan, where I do not believe he has been yet, where he could go see those troops with their inaction and sacrificing for the country.
John Bigger.
Yeah, well, look, the vice president has certainly been all over this country.
But the president of the United States has not been to a war zone to visit the troops. He's been president for over a year.
We don't know what this is really at. So, I mean, I think it's unfair to the president to try to imply something it may not be.
John Brayburn, you mentioned Mike
Pence. We know the president has not been to the war zone to visit the troops. That is a fact. Why can't the president go visit them? Yeah, is he afraid? Is he scared?
I feel pretty confident that if you were to do a poll among the troops today versus the troops 2 years ago of how they feel about this president and standing up for people who are in the military, I think this president would do quite well.
We'll see.
John Brabender, you mentioned the vice president. He's going to be attending Friday's Olympic opening ceremony with the father of Otto Warmbier, of course, the American college student who died after the treatment he received in North Korea. You've advised Pence, look, is this the place to politicize, the opening ceremony?
I don't think he is. I think what he's doing is, if you looked at, for example, the North Koreans when they arrived, it was the biggest PR event that anybody has ever seen.
Well, we expect that of North Korea.
We do. And what the vice president is there to do is to remind people that while we're seeing sort of this charade on one hand, that every day, including this very moment, there's a clock ticking where they are moving closer to a nuclear bomb that could reach America. And he is not going to let them fool the rest of the world. In fact, I believe they are going to announce even harsher terms in dealing with North Korea because time's running out.
John Brabender, our Republican strategist, Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist, taking a look at the news midweek. John, Jamal, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Gaming officials in Massachusetts are meeting today to review the Wynn Casino slated to open near Boston Harbor next year. The meeting comes a day after casino mogul Steve Wynn stepped down as CEO of his company following allegations of sexual misconduct spanning decades. Wynn has denied the allegations. He said he's leaving because of a, quote, avalanche of negative publicity. Joining us now is Alexandra Berzon of The Wall Street Journal. She's in Las Vegas. And Alexandra, you're one of the reporters who broke the story about Steve Wynn last month with these explosive allegations against him. What has the reaction been today to his resignation?
I mean, I think it's quite an extraordinary development and probably quite shocking at first to people here because Steve Wynn, it's hard to overstate his importance both to the company that has his name and his signature on it, but also to the global casino industry and the state of Nevada. He's really considered probably one of the most important people in the history of Las Vegas in terms of just the development that he did there. So I think there's still a lot of grappling with, you know, a lot of people are saying this is kind of like an end of an era, but he still, you know, as far as we know, has a very hefty stake in the company. And so it's not quite as completely separated. I mean, I think there's still things to play out and be determined here.
And do we know what he'll be walking away with, what his severance package is?
I don't think that's clear at this point, but our understanding is that he will still be living in his villa on the site for at least a year and that he, or for a year, and that he does still retain this very sizable ownership in the company.
What does this resignation mean for his empire overall?
Well, it's a huge change. I mean, they have a number of projects that they're working on in Las Vegas that are in the planning stages. So, you know, there had been a kind of notion with Wynn that he's really the visionary and is incredibly important to the company. They had been, you know, had that in their SEC filings, you know, statements about how important he is to this company. Should he ever leave, that would be a major impact. I believe what we're seeing so far, I haven't looked in the last few minutes, but I believe the stock is actually doing really well. So investors seem to be responding, thinking that this will be a positive for the company, but that certainly had not been the indication prior to this kind of situation.
What questions do you have at this point as this story unfolds?
Well, I think the questions will be what happens with the company in terms of their response. I mean, at this point, the board actually gave him quite an endorsement in their letter last night. They said that they really had great admiration and respect or something along those lines. So it'll be interesting to see sort of how this all gets handled with his involvement in the company, how the investigations go, and, you know, if whether there's other people that come forward in terms of allegations or clarifying anything about the past as well.
That's Alexandra Berzon of The Wall Street Journal speaking with us from Las Vegas about Steve Wynn's resignation from the company he founded. Alexandra, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Travis Holcomb, the original Here and Now DJ Sessions DJ, is back with us once again. He's at KCRW in Santa Monica. Hi, Travis.
Hey, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well, and it sounds like you have brought us the funk today, as you often
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Always. Always.
Okay. All right. Well, let's start with the band Super Organism. This is their song, Everybody Wants to Be Famous.
Feeling like a frost and staring at the stars. It doesn't matter the cost. Everybody wants to be famous. I'm calling the shots. So, see you over a bar. It doesn't matter the cost. Seems like everybody wants to be famous. I think it could be.
I like that. Very poppy.
It is. And this group actually has a really interesting genesis. It's an 8-person group with a bunch of New Zealand expats living in London who happen to meet an 18-year-old Japanese girl going to boarding school in Maine. Hmm. And she wrote some lyrics to a song that they were kind of stuck on. And it slowly started generating a lot of hype online. It was their first single, Something for Your Mind. And this was all like around this time last year, like January of 2017. So I don't think they planned for any of the success, but they have their debut album coming out on March 2nd. And Everybody Wants to Be Famous is the first official single from that album.
And what do you like about it?
It's super catchy. There's like a whimsical, fun, little kitschy element of it that reminds me a lot of kind of early Beck, like Odelay and Loser era Beck. It's just like a looseness and a funness to it that I really like.
All right, next, you have brought us Sydney Gish with Not But For You, Bunny. Now, Sydney Gish, we read, was going to classes in college at the same time she was putting out this album. What else should we know about her?
Yeah, she's a 20-year-old undergrad from Boston, went to Northeastern University while she was recording this album, I guess. And it came out on New Year's Eve. You can pick it up over on her Bandcamp page. But I just, it's so catchy and funky. It's got kind of like a Tom Tom Club Genius of Love feel to it. And that's probably what drew me into that song in particular on this album.
And Pitchfork, by the way, highlighted her self-deprecating wit and melodic complexity.
Yeah, I mean, I think this song in particular is about just liking some guy who doesn't really know you exist. So I feel like that's, you know, the themes that she kind of takes on throughout the album are just sort of everyday stories kind of like that.
Okay, up next we've got the song Follow Me. This is by the Queens-based duo The Shacks.
I hear a sound.
We know about The Shacks?
Well, The Shacks are kind of having a moment right now in the national spotlight because their song Strange Effect, which actually also stars Shannon Wise, the singer, is featured in a brand new Apple commercial. But on their website, they say The Shacks are like the Five Keys met Neil Young to cut a record with Brigitte Bardot, but in English. And I think that's a really apt description. I mean, this song that we heard, Follow Me, it feels like if someone told you this was a single from 1967 that just became unearthed, you wouldn't really bat an eye. I mean, it has a very kind of like vintage feeling that, that the Shacks imbue.
It's got a dreamy sound to it, too.
Yeah, and she's got just such a warm and casually seductive delivery that's just easy to fall for.
All right, up next we've got the musician Ty Siegel. This is called Everyone's a Winner. Very different, very lo-fi, this one, Travis. What do you like in this song?
Well, first of all, it's a cover of the Hot Chocolate song, Everyone's a Winner. Mm-hmm. And that is one of my favorite tracks of all time. And when I heard that Ty Siegel was going to cover it, I was like, I don't know if that's going to work. Because his whole aesthetic is really fuzzed out and reverb-drenched. And the original by Hot Chocolate has got like a very soulful, funky disco feel. But he pulls it off. And when you hear it, it makes total sense as a choice of a cover for Siegel. He kind of flips that guitar riff and gives it a new edge, making the song kind of all of his own.
And this is going to be his 10th album, by the way, Ty Siegel.
Yeah, he's been very prolific. Kind of, you know, he's well known in underground rock and roll circles, but not really yet in the mainstream. But I do feel like this new album, Freedom's Goblin, sounds a lot like what I feel like a lot of people wanted from Jack White when he was doing his solo work.
Okay, we have time for one more. This is a Colombian-American artist, Caliuchis, with After the Storm, featuring Tyler, the Creator, and Bootsy Collins.
So if you need a hero, just look in the mirror. No one's gonna save you now, so you better save yourself.
This is that Travis Holcomb sound, although there's so many things that could fit into that category. But let's start with Caliuchis. Who is Caliuchis?
So she's sort of, you know, I feel like last year things started to come together for her. She made a bunch of a couple really great singles. had a couple guest appearances on some high-profile releases by Gorillaz and Miguel, and she even got a Grammy nomination for a song that she did with an artist named Daniel Caesar called Get You. But After the Storm, this song is the first single from her proper debut album that's coming out this spring. And in addition to Tyler, the Creator, and Bootsy Collins, is also some work from Bad Bad Not Good on this track, which is a KCRW favorite.
What do you think you get when you put so many different musicians together on one project like this? Does it always work?
No, it doesn't always work. A lot of times I feel like when you have a high-profile guest, the song can often take the personality of the guest rather than the artist who is putting it together. One of the things about Kaliuchis, though, is I feel like even though Tyler and Bootsy Collins' two strong personalities are on this track, it sounds like a Kaliuchis track.
That's Travis Holcomb, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. Travis, thanks as always.
Hey, thank you, Jeremy.
The U.S. speed skating team has a shot at redemption this Saturday night when the women line up for the 3,000-meter race at the Pyeongchang Winter Games. The 2014 Games in Sochi, they were a disaster for American speed skaters who were shut out of the medal count.
Another disappointing day for speed skating for the United States, matching a disappointing Games. The first time in 30 years that the U.S. has not won a medal in speed skating.
The U.S. speed skating team trying to make sense out of why its heavily favored skaters are finishing so poorly in the Games. And a suspect is emerging, the high-tech racing suits made by Under Armour.
Yes, the suit took the early blame, but then a post-Olympic review by the U.S. team showed the problem was actually the skaters weren't as good as everyone told them they were. And Under Armour doubled down on its commitment to them. Clay Dean helped design the new suit they'll be wearing this year. He's Under Armour's chief innovation officer. And Clay, the last game's Mach 39 suit was called the fastest ever designed. It was vindicated by the studies, but was there still something you wanted to prove?
You bet. We had things to prove and to come back and a little bit of redemption of our technical capability and to prove that that we do indeed create and innovate and design great equipment.
We'll talk about this year's suit. Last time there was a vent, some of the athletes complained that the vent that went down the back that was supposed to let their bodies breathe a little bit was actually letting air in. This year, no vent and three fabrics. Talk about the fabrics and how they're stitched together.
I think the vent, you know, whether the vent was an issue or not, I think sometimes psychologically those things play into it. We think venting the body is still important, and our materials do breathe, which is important. And you're exactly right. There's three different types of material on the uniform. So when you see them in the games, you'll see different colors. So the main body of the suit is a dark blue color, and we call that Aeroprint. It's about three different layers, polyurethane on the outside, and it does create a little bit of a dimpled look on the surface when you see it. There's white material, which you see on the arms and the legs, and that is what we call H1, and that's a proprietary material that we've developed here at Under Armour. It's amazing. When you look at all the materials used, we looked at about 100 different materials in about 250 different configurations that we tested on the athletes, tested in the wind tunnel, to try to get the best combination of flow, comfort, movement, and speed.
Well, and talk about it's an asymmetrical design. The seaming runs differently than, you know, normally we think of a seam that goes, let's say, from under your arm down to your ankle. Talk about the seaming.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest innovations in the suit is really the configuration of the suit itself and how it's actually built. We started to look at how was the athlete in motion? Where did he spend the most of his time? And when you look at a speed skater, they're leaning forward and they're leaning to the left, and that's about 80% of the time that they're on the ice. And so we designed a suit that when they're leaned forward and leaning to the left, that was the most comfortable configuration in the suit. Hmm. Quite honestly, when you stand up straight in the suit, which is how traditionally everything is fit, that's probably not the most comfortable position to wear the suit. But down low to the left, that's where the suit fits you perfectly. So the right leg is a little bit longer in terms of its material. The seaming, so when we look at the around the waistband, you'll see a rise from left to right. So it actually doesn't pull or tug on the body. The suit is really cut and designed with all of its seaming down the legs to enable the right over left movement of the leg as he's skating and powering away. So it really, for us, makes us look at other sports in the same way of how would we maximize the athlete's movement.
Look, it's so fascinating to see how much Under Armour is involved with this team, and I'm presuming other sponsors do this as well. But Under Armour also paid for a German cyclist who competed in the Tour de France to lead brutal bike workouts for speed skaters. They brought in, I think, a Tai Chi expert, a former Navy SEAL to lead team building activities. But when it comes to the suits, do you worry about part of this is psychological? And the athletes might think that just by putting on this magical suit, it's going to make them win. I mean, how do you deal with the psychology of first overcoming that the suits didn't make them win 4 years ago, and then pulling back on letting them think that it's going to be the suit that makes them win this time?
So that's a good question. I think when we look at the total activity, the things that you mentioned, the speed skaters have actually been skating in our suits and iterating with them for about a year. So they're familiar with what the suits can do. And what we've been able to do is to constantly fine-tune, iterate. So the suits that they're going to skate with in the Olympics this week, really, they're very familiar with. They've been skating with them in the World Finals and the World Championships. They've been winning medals. We think they're perhaps more comfortable than they've ever been with a suit before, and that helps the psyche of the athlete.
Well, best of luck to you and them this weekend.
Thank you so much. We're really excited to watch. Competition is why we exist. We think we've given them some pretty awesome equipment.
We wish you no wardrobe malfunctions.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Clay Dean, Under Armour's Chief Innovation Officer ahead of the Games in Pyeongchang. Clay, thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Jeremy, I'd like one just to wear around the house. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.